Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Writer Joseph O'Connor, good morning.
Hello, Brendan. How are you?
Good. So, Joe, we're going to talk about your life in five songs. And you are one of my dream candidates for this slot, because I know music is important to you and you think about it and listen to it a lot. But I want to talk to you first about your new novel, The Ghosts of Rome. And it's the follow-up to My Father's House, and I have to say I'm not one for sequels or series usually, but I loved being back in World War II Rome with these people. So Hugh O'Flaherty not as central in this one, but the gang's all there, and these were all real people to varying extents. Remind us about this extraordinary Irish priest and this kind of motley group he gathered around him and what they did.
Yeah, so Hugh O'Flaherty was born in 1898 in Kishkeme, County Cork, and moved with his family to Killarney, where he was brought up. His father was a golf professional in Killarney, and Hugh, in his early 20s, went off to be a school teacher. When he was 27, he went to train for the priesthood. He was a bright man, a scholarly fellow. He achieved 3 PhDs in the course of his life in theology. And he went to work in Rome. He worked in the Vatican Curia. So he's there in 1939. The war starts. The Nazis invade Italy. They get closer and closer to Rome. And as people who've been to Rome will know, the Vatican City is an enclave within wider Rome. It's actually an independent state. It became independent in 1929. And it was neutral during the Second World War. So Hugh realised that if he could smuggle fugitives from the Nazis into the Vatican City, that he'd be able to save them. So he put together a group of 7 or 8 very disparate people, women and men from different backgrounds, different faiths and no faith. And they worked with extraordinary heroism throughout this period, the 10-month period of the Nazi occupation of Rome. The figures, depending on which historian you read, figures vary on how many lives he saved, but it may have been up to 7,000 lives. So there's a lot of music in My Father's House and in The Ghosts of Rome, because in my version of the story, this group of 7 or 8, they meet as a choir. They form themselves into a choir because it gives them a pretext to meet. And while they are singing, they're passing notes and plans back and forth about how they're going to, what the next mission is going to be, who they're going to try and save. So in the first book, My Father's House, the Contessa Giovanna Landini is an important character, but not the central book. And I realised pretty quickly into writing My Father's House that I would have to give her a book of her own. So in The Ghosts of Rome, Hugh O'Flaherty is there, but the central character is Joe Landini. So again, a lot of music of different sorts. Delia Murphy, the folk singer, is a character in the book. So there's Irish folk, there's jazz, there's Italian opera, there's religious music. And it's one thing that strikes you when you go to Rome.
Even the Nazi commander has a kind of a reasonably sophisticated musical palette in this.
It's Rome is an intensely musical city, you know, and I've got to know Rome a lot over the last 3 years. I was adding it up the other day. I think we spent like 8 months in Rome while I was researching these two books. And you hear music everywhere, on every corner, from coming out the doors of every church. There are concert halls. There's a great tradition of classical music. There were jazz clubs in Rome in the 1940s. So it's one of the things I try and get into my books, and particularly these two books, My Father's House and The Ghosts of Rome, is a sense of what Rome sounds like.
Yeah, yeah. And we definitely get the sounds and also the feel of Rome, and the texture is all there.
Yeah.
You mentioned, I think you call her Delia Carney in the book, Delia Murphy, again, a real person and a kind of a renowned singer. And she was the wife of the ambassador at that stage from Ireland to Vatican.
So Delia Murphy was her professional name, and she was a big star. I mean, John Kelly was telling me recently, in the 1940s, Delia Murphy was kind of the closest thing Ireland had to a pop star. Like she didn't just do ballad sessions in pubs. She did albums and concert tours, and she was really, really well known. She married a man called Thomas Kiernan, who's a former director general of Radio Éireann, and he was appointed at a later stage to be Ireland's ambassador in Rome. So Delia should not have been involved with this escape line because Ireland is a neutral country and there was a lot of anxiety, you know, amongst the Irish government back in Dublin about the activities of the escape line, yeah, that it would jeopardise neutrality. But she was a tough, no-nonsense, kind of kick-ass character. She's a lot of fun to write about and she was of great assistance to Hugh. But again, she brings
and
her
musicality. And did any of them talk much about this after? Are you building a kind of an augmented reality based, yes, on scraps, really? Like, did Delia Murphy ever talk about it much?
Very little. And the thing that really strikes you about this story is that it's full of silences. You know, the people who were involved did not give interviews. They didn't go on chat shows. Like, to the best of my knowledge, and I've researched it fairly thoroughly, Hugh O'Flaherty really only gave one interview about this subject in the course of his life. He sat down with a journalist friend and they talked for, I think, a couple of days. And he said, this is what I have to say about it, and that's it.
Okay.
So I think partly it was modesty, and partly, like, you're very struck when you research the history of wars, that people are silent often afterwards, and sometimes you see it in the men in particular. They've seen awful things and they don't want to talk about it. And then I've often come to wonder since My Father's House came out, if part of Hugh's silence was actually to do with the fact that after his priesthood in Rome, he retired to Kerry, where he was from and where he loved, and people are intensely proud of him, as they should be. But I wonder still in the 1950s and 60s, would there have been some anxiety about the fact that Hugh helped a lot of escaped British prisoners of war?
Yeah.
So they were very modest people, and that's why there is space for there to be novels about them. If there was a really great factual book about these events, then who would write a novel? But the fact that people have not told their story means there's a space for the novelist to go into.
Okay. So music is important to you, as important as books?
In some ways more important. I listen to music every day. I couldn't imagine a day without music. It's been important to me since I was a young teenager. I would almost stop in Grafton Street and listen to any busker before I'd read a novel. I mean, I love the novel in a very special way,
yeah,
and in a unique way. I don't think there's any higher art form. At the same time, nothing really touches us or moves us or excites us the way music does.
You're right, yeah. I think there's lines from pop songs that have probably meant more to me. I've learned more from pop songs about life than I have from books, actually. Was it your music teacher in school who introduced you to the rock and roll greats, yeah?
Well, we did have a great teacher. Jarlath Dowling was his name. He was our music teacher. And he was an unusual man, a Catholic priest who loved Beethoven and Bach and religious music. But he would often play us a track by the Stones or the Beatles or the experimental composer Roger Doyle. He was a very, very open-hearted man about music. So that was part of it. It was also, I think I was lucky to become a young teenager in Dublin in the late 70s and early 80s when there was an absolute burgeoning explosion of a new kind of music and you really felt that it was part of your life and that the musicians were speaking for you.
And that brings us to your first choice today. So tell me about becoming aware of the Boomtown Rats then.
Yeah, when I was in the summer of 1977, I was 14 and I got a little job making the tea on a building site near where we lived in Dunleary. And running errands for the electricians and the carpenters and all of that. And I was pals with a fellow called Huey Madden, who was an apprentice bricklayer from Sallynoggin, a very nice fella. He was in his early 20s and he was into his music. And he'd say to me, what music are you listening to? And I would say whatever was on Top of the Pops that week, Slade or the Sweet or the Quo or Susie Quattro. And he'd say, well, that's all very well, but now there's two things you want to get into. One is Bob Dylan. You know, he's just the absolute greatest. But you're from Dunleary, I'm from Dunleary. You really want to get into this band, the Boomtown Rats. So as it happened, I had seen on the way to school from the bus, you know, posters and graffiti about the Rats. And in the basement of the late great Murray's record shop on Georgia Street in Dunleary, there was a jukebox that would play, you know, Mark Bolan and early Bowie. And there would be flyers about Boomtown Rats gigs. I hadn't actually heard them. And one day Huey brought in a cassette played them to me. I was absolutely blown away. And I loved the fact that they were from my town.
Yeah.
And when a band is from your place, you kind of feel that they're singing for you. And that, you know, I I've been lucky over the years to get to know Bob Geldof a bit. And I remember telling him once, I kind of thought I was in the Boomtown Rats. And he said, well, you feckin' weren't, you know. But it was great. And then in the August of that year, the Rats played in Dalymount Park, and an amazing gig with Thin Lizzy, Graham Parker and The Rumour, and Fairport Convention, all very fine bands. But myself and Huey went along to see one band and one band only, and it was the Boomtown Rats. The first gig I ever went to, and I remember them playing this song, Barefootin', and just the sheer energy and passion and drive and intensity of the performance. I'd never heard any music like it. And they went on, this is a cover, they went on to write great songs of their own.
Yeah.
But there is something about the commitment of this live performance that brings back that lovely, hot summer day in 1977 when I was 14.
Okay, here's Joseph O'Connor's first choice, Barefoot in the Boomtown Rats. That's the visceral energy of the early Boomtown Rats there, Barefoot.
Imagine hearing that when you're 14 years of age. Yeah. It's the first gig you ever went to. Just the lights came on, Brendan, and they never went back off again.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, even like people talk a lot about U2, but like they forget sometimes the Boomtown Rats changed Ireland long before U2, Rat Trap getting to number one in 1978, seeing them on Top of the Pops. There was something like... The Boomtown Rats are probably a bit more post-punk or a punk pub rock kind of outfit, but there's something very Irish about punk, or something very punk about the Irish, isn't there?
Oh yeah, there is. And I mean, people have written books and made programmes about the fact that Irishness is a big ingredient in punk, as it had been in British popular music ever since the Beatles. I mean, all of the Beatles had some Irish connection. But John Lydon considered himself, you know, and his autobiography is No Irish, No Blacks, No Dogs. The Clash, you know, many of the punk bands, the Smiths, who we're going to talk about later on. I think it was that spirit of rebelliousness that the Pogues would later kind of tap into. And they realised that, you know, the early music of... the Dubliners, for example, is kind of more punk than the Pistols. So I think we kind of did a gift that to the great movement that was punk, particularly English punk. And it wouldn't have been what it was if it wasn't for that kind of flavour of Irishness and the Irish inheritance.
Which kind of brings us on to the Undertones. Your next choice is Get Over You by the Undertones. Why this?
Well, I remember listening as a young teenager to... you know, a pirate radio, ARD, Radio Dublin, Dave Fanning would be on, and the late Jerry Ryan. It was, as I was saying a few minutes ago, it's just an exciting time to be a young person into music in Ireland. And hearing the Undertones the first few times, and I suppose people in Dublin, well, I won't generalise it, but, you know, myself, I think that there were received notions about the north of Ireland.
Yeah.
And that they came in black and white, and that it was guns and riots and soldiers and bombs and repression. And it's not to say that that wasn't part of the picture. It certainly was. But there was also kind of the everyday normality of teenagers just trying to grow up and going to school and fancying people and falling in love and out of love, and teenage dreams being hard to beat, and all of that. And there was also, I think, with the Undertones, Just the kind of wit and vividness, the great humour, and their fantastic kind of post-punk tunes, but a slight kind of tongue-in-cheek in one of their songs. My cousin Kevin, as his mother bought him a synthesizer, she got the Human League into Advisor. It's pure Ulster kind of salty wit. And this song, Get Over You, I just think it's a cracker. You know, it's an absolute belter from one of the most fantastic Irish bands of that era.
Okay, Joe O'Connor's second choice, Get Over You, The Undertones. That's Get Over You, The Undertones, Joseph O'Connor's second choice today. So listen, your next choice is The Smiths. As I remember it, people who like The Smiths really like The Smiths. Were you one of those people?
I loved The Smiths so much that I had this problem that I didn't want anyone else to love them.
Yeah.
And I still kind of resent the fact that millions of people all over the world love The Smiths. To me, they should be a private pleasure. But anyway, The Smiths came along at a time when it seemed that it was compulsory for English bands to have a non-English word in the name of the band. Spandau Ballet and Cabaret Voltaire and Depeche Mode, all very fine bands. But then suddenly along comes The Smiths, and it could not be more ordinary. And yet when you listened, nobody had ever played the guitar like Johnny Marr had. There had never been lyrics like those written and performed by Stephen Patrick Morrissey. I wish that I could say I was at their first ever Dublin gig. I wasn't, but I was at the second one, which was in November 1984 at the SFX in town, a venue I'm sad to say is no longer there. But just a wonderful band. And again, the Irishness was absolutely there. The Smiths are from Manchester.
I had Johnny Marr on last year, right?
I heard it.
And it was like talking to a guy from a Thai. Like he's mentioning Joe Dolan and various show bands, like as if he grew up with it. And very, I said to him, "Were the Smiths an Irish band?" And he said, "Yeah."
Well, he described himself in interviews often as not English, but Mancunian Irish. His parents, John Joseph Marr and Patricia Doyle, from near Athy. I heard his interview when he was talking with you about playing in the ballroom in Athy where his parents met. Morrissey would often describe himself as 10 parts Crumlin and 10 parts Old Trafford. And both of my parents came from Keep Road in Crumlin. So I kind of felt that here's a band that once again are looking at Irishness in a different way. A bit like, you know, the Rats did and the Undertones did. I think the Smiths were a band who really redefined what the word Irish meant and did so with such kind of lyricism and loveliness.
Yeah. And that Irish melancholy always there. Okay, Joe O'Connor's third choice, The Smiths, What Difference Does It Make? Smiths, What Difference Does It Make? And that's Joe O'Connor's third choice today.
I should say, Brendan, just about that gig at the SFX, I discovered in the course of preparing to come and meet you this week, I was looking around on YouTube, and that entire gig is on YouTube. It was November the 13th, 1984, at the SFX, and the entire hour and 20 minutes of glorious fun of the Smiths playing in Dublin for the second time is up there for everybody.
Okay, so there's a certain cohort now would be off to find that. So listen, your next choice is a piece of religious music. So tell me about Hildegard von Bingen, or she's known as Saint Hildegard of Bingen also, an extraordinary woman.
Yeah, she's an amazing woman. And I came across her through the process of researching my father's house and the ghosts of Rome, because as I said, there is some religious music among the many other types of music in the book. Hildegard was born 1,000 years ago, kind of. She lived from 1098 to 1179. She was a nun and an abbess, but also a poet, scientist, philosopher, a medical writer. Her book Physica, which, as I say, is 1,000 years old, is a kind of treatise on the healing properties of plants and crystals. So she was 1,000 years ahead of kind of the New Age. And in her spare time, she was one of the greatest composers of her era, and a very complete record of what she wrote, remarkably, still exists. We have most of the pieces.
So it was written down, was it?
She wrote them down. She was one of the first people to write them down, and they've been catalogued and documented over the years. And just absolutely beautiful, spiritual, haunting music that I just find so touching. And often when I was writing The Ghosts of Rome, I would have music on in the background to try to underline the emotion of a scene I was trying to write. So I got very close to Hildegard's music, and I really love it, and I find it very healing and very touching and uplifting.
Okay, so here's Joseph O'Connor's fourth choice, Hildegard von Bingen. And I don't have a classical education now, but I'm going to say Overtus Sapientiae.
Yeah, that's what I would say.
Okay, that's Joseph O'Connor's fourth choice, Hildegard von Bingen, Overtus Sapientiae. Isn't that extraordinary? Echoing down from 1,000 years ago.
It's absolutely amazing that we can access the feelings and emotions that somebody who lived 1,000 years ago had when she wrote that music. And I think it's why music touches us in a way that almost no other art form does, because it's about emotion and feeling. When you listen to that piece of music, no matter what your religious persuasion is, I think there is wonder in it, and there's mystery in it, and there's something that is so deeply human that we respond to when we hear that music from 10 centuries ago.
Yeah. Do you get more of a connection with the ancient and the centuries from spending that time in Rome?
Oh, well, I mean, Rome is a city that it's so old, and yet large neighbourhoods of it haven't really changed much. I love that about it, and I think most visitors really respond to that. Funny enough, James Joyce lived in Rome around 1904, 1905, where he, improbably enough, he worked as a bank teller. And he for somebody who really could not handle money, he hated Rome. And he wrote to his brother Stanislaus that living around all these kind of crumbling temples and toppling pillars was giving him nightmares. and he wished that the Romans would let the ruins rot. Which I think is a pretty harsh judgment on Rome. But you have a very deep sense of the past there. Rome kind of works in millenniums, you know.
Yeah, yeah. You do, the book just brings you, though, so much into every nook and cranny and the textures of the place and everything. That is one of the things I really loved about it. Okay, so your final choice is kind of an unlikely one. It's a jazz blues standard called Body and Soul. Why yeah. this?
Well, so this is by the great Coleman Hawkins, and there's a character in My Father's House and in The Ghosts of Rome called Johnny May, who's based on a real person who did exist and who helped the escape line. But I know almost nothing about him. I found one photograph of him. I know nothing except that he was an East End Londoner, and I've given him this history in the book of being a jazz musician, a saxophonist. So it allows you to bring kind of 1940s Soho jazz clubs into the kind of texture of the book. And Johnny May's hero is Coleman Hawkins. And I just love the kind of beautiful, mellow, expressive blues playing that Coleman Hawkins had. And again, I tried to make that be one of the textures, one of the musical kind of tones in The Ghosts of Rome. So if I had to choose one genre of music as my favourite, which thank God I don't, but I sometimes think it would be the blues. I think even though it's quite kind of musically restrictive, I think it's capable of expressing this huge range of feeling. And I think it's just the sheer beauty of Coleman Hawkins and his mastery of the instrument. I think it's just a glorious sound.
Okay, just before we play that and finish up, there's lots of interesting texts here. So enjoyed listening to Joseph on the show this morning. My granduncle, Father Tom, was part of Hugh O'Flaherty's network in Rome during the war. He too was very reluctant to speak about it, but my father got a bit of drink into him one night and he told us amazing stories about dodging the Nazis. Truly heroic stuff, and we're all still so proud of him. And then someone else is saying, delighted to hear Joe O'Connor speak of Delia Murphy. Back in the day, she would arrive at the Galty Moor Ballroom in Cricklewood and demand to sing on the stage in the hall. She had an amazing voice. We'd have the whole ballroom dancing to her songs. Even the bigger bands like the Big Eight and Joe Dolan would stand back to give her the stage. She was an amazing lady.
So, she certainly was. I mean, there are stories of Delia was playing in the Opera House in Belfast on the night that the Luftwaffe bombed the city. As she said herself later, that's what you call a mixed review. she led the crowd out into the streets of Belfast and sang for them out in the street all night to keep everybody's spirits up. An amazing woman.
Extraordinary. Okay. So The Ghosts of Rome is published by Harville Secker and it's out next week. People probably
get
it. It's
out on Thursday.
Thursday. And Joe, you'll be in conversation with Alex Clark in the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary on Saturday night, 1st of February at 8 p.m. And people can get tickets for that at paviliontheatre.ie. So Joseph O'Connor, thank you so much. And we'll finish up now on your final choice. This is Coleman Hawkins and Body and Soul. Thanks, Joe.
Great pleasure, Brendan. Thank you.
Radio 1.